This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In this edition today, our bulletin of church news to be followed by Panorama and then our feature of justice and peace. Today we shall close with our sports roundup. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Tuesday marked 1,000 days since Russia invaded Ukraine, and to commemorate the day, Pope Francis reiterated his call for peace in Ukraine, writing in his message on X, the former Twitter, the Holy Father said that war is always a defeat. I call again for the madness of violence to end. Then he urged the international community, saying, may we commit to justice and lasting peace, and let us pray for the people of Ukraine. At the ongoing G20 summit in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin has challenged wealthier countries to forgive the debts of developing nations and take responsibility for their past decisions. He was speaking on the topic of reform of the global governance institutions. In his speech on Monday, Cardinal Parolin underscored the power shift from nation states to international multilateral organizations that has taken place in the last century. As a solution, the Secretary of State called for a change, a rethinking of the frameworks that should facilitate effective international cooperation. He stressed the importance of ensuring peace and stability while also learning how to react to new challenges and create global mechanisms that can respond to environmental, public health, cultural and social issues, as well as artificial intelligence. All of these developments, he said, must maintain the respect for fundamental human rights, social rights, and care for the environment. Citing the apostolic exhortation Laudate Deum of Pope Francis, Cardinal Parolin warned against a global authority concentrated in one person or in an elite with excessive power. He said any future reforms to world governance must take into account the principles of subsidiarity and equal participation so that, as the Pope wrote, effective global rules can permit providing for the global safeguarding. To do this, Parolin explained, wealthier nations need to recognize the impact of their past decisions and forgive debts of countries who will never have the ability to repay them. A number of prominent buildings in several cities of the world will turn red on 20th November in order to mark Red Wednesday. The Catholic charity Aid to the Church Needs annual campaign for persecuted Christians. Lisa Zengarini tells us more.
Some 300 events will be taking place in more than 20 countries throughout the week marking Red Wednesday, including masses, talks, live streams, concerts, and parliamentary discussions. Britain, Ireland, the US, Canada, Australia, but also France, Italy, and Germany are among them. Ireland plans to light 26 of its cathedrals. In France, the event will include testimonies from those who have endured persecution, while ACN Germany plans to host a concert that will be live-streamed. In Britain, Cardinal Vincent Nicholls of Westminster has endorsed the campaign in a video message inviting parishes and individuals to participate in activities to raise awareness and pray for suffering Christians. In London, where a special Mass will be taking place on Wednesday evening, famous buildings such as the Westminster Parliament will be lighted up, and the faithful across the country are encouraged to wear red, symbolising the blood of the martyrs. In the run-up to the day, ACN UK has also asked people to sign an open letter calling on the British Foreign Secretary to channel more taxpayer-funded overseas development aid to support Christians and other religious minorities. Also joining this year for the first time is the Church of England, which has provided a range of resources that individuals, parishes and organisations can use to support the cause of persecuted Christians. According to ACN's latest biennial report, Christian persecution has significantly worsened between 2022 and 2024. The report highlights the displacement of Christians, forced marriage of women and girls, and anti-conversion laws, and for the first time includes Nicaragua, due to the increased targeting and expulsion of clergy by the Sandinista regime. I am Lisa Zengarini.
The newly consecrated Bishop of Embu Diocese in Kenya has called for strengthened family values and support of vocations. In his maiden speech at his episcopal consecration on November 16th, Bishop Peter Kimani Ndungu said that the focus in families should be on youths and children who need the spiritual guidance. He said that families can be strengthened by teaching these young people to love the church, to love the vocation to the family, to love the vocation to religious life, and the vocation to the priesthood. In his speech at the event that was held at Embu University grounds, about 130 kilometers from Kenya's capital city, Nairobi, the new local ordinary of Embu Diocese also underscored the role of small Christian communities in nurturing vocations. Thus, he called for a renewed commitment to the growth of the small Christian communities in Kenya, which he said is part of the Association of Member Episcopal Conferences in Eastern Africa, AMECEA. Pope Francis appointed Bishop Ndugu to be the head shepherd of Embu Diocese on August 15th. He filled the post that had been left vacant following the transfer of Bishop Paul Kariuki Njiru to Kenya's Diocese of Wote. On the occasion of the 8th World Day of the Poor, marked on Sunday, November 17th, the Executive Secretary of the Catholic Commission for Justice and Peace of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Angola and Sao Tome has called for concrete initiatives in reaching out to the poor in society. In his homily during the celebration at the Sacred Heart of Jesus Major Seminary in Luanda, Father Celestine Epalanga invited the government to provide basic needs for the population of the country. Reflecting on poverty in Angola, Father Epalanga revealed the fact that over 40% of the population, which is around 17 million people, live below the poverty line. He underscored the need to see the poor as fully human, not as mere statistics. Looking at the theme of this year's World Day of the Poor, the prayer of the poor rises to God, Father Epalanga cited Pope Francis' teaching, which emphasizes integrating the poor into the spiritual and pastoral life of the church. You are tuned to the Daily Africa service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
I am Father Paul Samasumo. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Monday that lives should not be put at risk in a standoff between police and hundreds of illegal miners stuck underground in a disused mine shaft. Ramaphosa says the miners should be recovered safely. The police have been blocking water and food supplies meant for the miners to force them out of the shaft and arrest them for entering an abandoned mine. Illegal miners, most of them from neighboring countries, occupied an abandoned mine in South Africa's northwest province in search of leftover gold. Some estimates have said that there could be about 3,000 miners still trapped underground. More than 1,000 illegal miners have so far resurfaced in recent weeks, but police say many more are still underground. Local residents and human rights groups have criticized authorities for blocking water and food supplies. Now President Ramaphosa has urged the police to respect the miners' rights and not put their lives at risk. It was unclear whether those that are still underground in the mineshaft are unwillingly to do so or simply are unable to come out. All of Burundi's prisoners charged with minor crimes must be released within the next 2 weeks in order to ease overcrowding in the country's prisons. This was the ultimatum that was recently given by the country's president. 477 prisoners have so far been released from the Muramvya prison. The country aims to release about 41% of its total prison population. An unprecedented surge of plastic waste flowing into a major hydroelectric dam in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is causing regular power cuts in major cities of the area. The electrical power cuts caused by the plastic waste is a huge challenge that local authorities are trying to solve. The Ruzizi Dam, located at the south end of Lake Kivu, which borders Rwanda, supplies the city of Bukavu and other areas with electricity. Power outages are also hitting local businesses. The problem is linked to the growing use of plastic, coupled with a lack of waste collection management in the region. Heavy rains have caused waste to flow down from the mountainous terrain into the lake where it collects and blocks machinery. Voters in Gabon have overwhelmingly approved a new constitution, Gabonese authorities have confirmed. The new constitution comes more than 1 year after soldiers overthrew the country's longtime president and seized power. Over 91% of voters approved the new constitution in a referendum held on Saturday. The draft constitution, which proposes sweeping changes that could prevent dynastic rule and transfers of power, needed more than 50% of votes cast to be adopted. You are tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
You are welcome to this week's edition of Justice and Peace. There are hundreds of millions of people around the world who are categorized as poor. From an economic point of view, a poor person is one who lacks the essentials for a dignified standard of living. These essentials include access to food, clothing, health care, education, shelter, safety, and income. People who live in poverty face many challenges in society, including prejudices against them and exclusion. Olivier De Schutter is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, and a specialist in economic and social rights. He has done extensive research on poverty and how it can be reduced. He explains more on this touching topic.
When we speak with people in poverty about their daily experience of being poor, they do refer, of course, to low incomes, to the lack of access to decent work, but they also speak about humiliation, about social maltreatment, about institutional maltreatment by social services and public administrations. In other terms, they speak about the hidden dimensions of poverty. All these negative stereotypes and humiliations that they have to face on a daily basis. Being poor is not simply having insufficient incomes to buy the goods and services that allow you to lead a decent life. It is also being stigmatized. It is being looked down upon. It is being discriminated against in access to employment, housing, healthcare, and education. And that is also what people in poverty say when asked about their experience of poverty.
You have indicated that eradicating poverty requires building inclusive society that move from a charity approach to a rights-based empowerment approach. How would you describe this approach?
In many countries, support going to people in poverty takes the form of ad hoc cash transfer systems, providing people with some level of support to avoid them falling into extreme poverty. But these schemes are sometimes temporary. They do not provide people with entitlements they may claim before independent institutions. They are poorly financed. Usually the budgets available are insufficient to really cover the needs of all the population. And the targeting of these measures is sometimes very poor. Many people living in extreme poverty, in fact, do not have access to social protection because they face a number of obstacles, including not being registered in social registries, not being informed about their rights, not being able to fill in forms online. And as a result, those measures do not benefit the very people that should be supported by social protection. In other terms, as long as we remain in an approach to tackling poverty that is based on charity from the state, and as long as we don't recognize that states have duties towards people in poverty who themselves are rights holders, we will fail to effectively address poverty. Poverty should be seen as a violation of human rights, and people in poverty should have access to recourse mechanisms if they are excluded from housing, from education, from access to jobs on a non-discriminatory basis, or indeed from social protection. And in many countries, this is difficult or even impossible to achieve. This is why my most recent report to the General Assembly of the UN is about protecting people in poverty from the negative stereotypes that affect them, the discrimination that they are facing in areas such as employment, housing, or education.
Talking about banning povertyism the same way than racism and sexism.
Indeed, for many years, we have recognized that racism, sexism, trans or homophobia should be outlawed, should be prohibited in legislation because they have no place in our world. Well, the same should be said about povertyism. In other terms, the negative treatment of people in poverty who are discriminated against simply because they live on low incomes, because they don't have the cultural codes, because they don't dress well, because they have the wrong accent. These are the indicators of poverty that very often lead employers not to recruit people, landlords not to rent their apartment to people in poverty, or that lead school teachers or school directors to exclude certain pupils from their classes or from their institutions.
You advocate for social justice. Is this possible in a world of growing inequality?
It is possible to do much more against poverty and to do much more for social justice. But we need to acknowledge that low-income countries in particular have to be helped. A calculation of the International Labour Office, ILO, is that the financing gap to cover all people living in low-income countries, some 711 million people, with the full range of social protection floors, that financing gap is equivalent to about $79 billion per year. That is the equivalent of 15.9% of the GDP of these low-income countries. That is impossible for them to achieve. However, these $79 billion represent just half the total official development assistance provided by OECD countries to developing countries in the year 2019. So it is achievable if the international community wants to help and decides that social protection should be on the top of the global development agenda. This is why, together with the ILO, we have proposed the establishment of a new international financing mechanism, the Global Fund for Social Protection. The idea is very simple. Countries who pledge to establish social protection floors, protecting their populations from the risks of existence, from birth to death, from child allowances and maternity benefits to old age pension and including unemployment benefits, sickness benefits and so on. These countries, if they present a credible plan to finance social protection with support from the international community, should be able to receive such support. And they should, of course, also commit to invest by mobilizing domestic resources to protect their population from life risks, and combined international support and the mobilization of domestic resources should allow these countries to implement Sustainable Development Goal number 1, the eradication of poverty, one of the targets of which is Target 1-3 about the universalization of social protection floors. That is something we can achieve, provided the political will is there, and provided we make this a priority for the international community.
Do you think that the eradication of poverty by 2030 is possible?
Given the food and energy crisis we are going through, the cost of living crisis that all countries are experiencing, of course, there is little room for being optimistic. The latest estimate is that the number of people in extreme poverty will increase by perhaps 95 million in comparison to the forecasts of 2019 as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, plus the food and energy crisis we are witnessing today. At the same time, these crises are a unique opportunity for countries to realize that there are many gaps in their social protection system. And I'm impressed by the fact that many countries have adopted social protection measures, expanding existing schemes or putting in place new schemes that were not existing before the crisis. And there is a renewed interest of governments in protecting their populations through social protection. So I believe this is an opportunity that can be seized if we provide the right funding, if we adopt a rights-based approach to social protection, providing people with entitlements they may claim and ensuring that governments feel that they have duties towards people in poverty. Yes, we can significantly reduce poverty, if not eradicate it by 2030, at least make significant progress towards this objective.
Olivier De Schutter, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, and a specialist in economic and social rights, speaking there to Florence Westgard of the United Nations News. And that was Justice and Peace for this week. This has been John Baptist Tomusime.
This is a sports roundup and welcome to the program. My name is Kenyatta Godfrey Kampamba.
World cross-country junior bronze medalist Matthew Kipruto led a Kenyan podium sweep in the men's race at the Cinque Mulini cross-country on Sunday in San Vittore in Italy. Kipruto clocked 27 minutes and 26 seconds to clinch the first place ahead of world under 25,000 meters champion Andrew Alamisi, who timed 27 minutes and 29 seconds in second place. In third place was Matthew Kipchumba, who clocked 27 minutes and 45 seconds. The win was Kipruto's first win since May 2022, when he ran 3 minutes and 49.66 seconds to win the men's 1,500 meters at the Ishikawa Championships in Ishikawa in Japan. The 19-year-old's last race was at the Birel 10-kilometer race in Praha in Czech Republic, where he timed 27 minutes and 50 seconds to claim third place. For Alamisi, the race was his second since he won gold at the World Under-20 Championships in Lima in Peru. In the women's 6.2-kilometer race, Ethiopia's Yaneneshi Shimket ran 18 minutes and 35 seconds to emerge victorious, while Sheila Jebet clocked 18 minutes and 48 seconds to finish second. Olympic 10,000-meter silver medalist Nadia Bartocletti of Italy came third in 89 minutes and 49 seconds. Jebet's performance came a week after she also finished second at the Cardiff Cross Country Challenge in Wales, clocking 20 minutes and 16 seconds. It also marks her second podium finish in 2024 after a year in which she has come so close yet so far from making the top three. Harambee Stars captain Michael Olunga has expressed his disappointment following Kenya's failure to secure a spot in the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations, the AFCON. Stars were eliminated after finishing third in their group, with their campaign ending in a 1-1 draw against Zimbabwe at the Peter Mokaba Stadium in Polokwane City in South Africa. In a media interview, Olunga admitted the fact that the team is struggling to come to terms with the outcome. The forward emphasized the need for reflection rather than blame game, pointing to a collective responsibility across the players, management and technical bench. Meanwhile, former Kenyan international Elijah Onsika has launched a scathing critique of Harambee Stars head coach Engin Firat following Kenya's failure to qualify for the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. A revered figure in Kenyan football, Onsika blamed Firat for the team's disappointing campaign, citing poor tactical choices, inconsistent squad selection, and a lack of hunger from the players. Speaking after the match, Onsika expressed his frustration with Firat's approach, particularly during the crucial opening group matches. Onsika's remarks come in the wake of Kenya's disappointing campaign, which started with a promising 2-1 win against Namibia and a draw with Zimbabwe, but spiraled into back-to-back losses to Cameroon. Meantime, the South African senior men's national team qualified for the 2025 AFCON last Thursday, and Bafana Bafana coach Bruce said it would be the perfect way to bring the curtain down on a successful year if a packed DHL Cape Town stadium is on hand to welcome the side as they make their way down the tunnel. The Belgian mentor insisted that while Bafana Bafana have qualified for the tournament to be held in Morocco next year, they would still go after the visitors as if it is still the first match of the qualifying campaign. South Africa hosts Sudan in a friendly match on Tuesday, but Bruce says this is not a friendly game because it is as important a game where they want to remain top of the group and that they also want to show something to the crowd that is expected at the stadium, he said. South Sudan coach Nicolas Dupuy said he has travelled to South Africa with only 15 players as they found the plane tickets too expensive to accommodate the whole team. He said facing a team like Bafana Bafana while they are in the midst of a challenging period off the field is a tough to ask to his players. But he insisted that despite the difficulties, they would still put up a fight against the South Africans. And you may well have heard that South African Football Association President Dan Jordan was arrested last week on Wednesday over allegations he used the organization's money for his own purposes. Jordan, a leading figure in bringing the 2010 World Cup to South Africa, had tried to get a court to halt his imminent arrest on Tuesday. The case has been adjourned to December 5th. Jordan, who was granted bail, denies any wrongdoing. And on that note, we come to the end of today's edition of our Sports Roundup. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. This is the Africa Service of Vatican Radio, and I am Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetu Jesus Christus.